Welcome to China Focus. I'm Jim Stevenson, along with Sarah Williams.
Hong Kong marks 1 month since the pro-democracy demonstrations began.
Beijing turns its attention towards the current constitution.
A Chinese general confesses to accepting bribes.
Our roundtable looks at the controversy concerning Confucius Institutes.
And a San Francisco Chinatown tour guide criticizes the historic neighborhood and its residents. Hello and welcome to China Focus.
Let's look at some of the biggest news stories this week.
Hong Kong student protest leaders are considering attending next month's conference of regional leaders in Beijing to make their case for democratic reforms in the Chinese territory. Alex Chow with the Federation of Students said during a rally late Thursday that organizers are discussing trying to attend the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, which begins November 5th. The conference is being attended by world leaders, including U.S. President Barack Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping. It is not clear whether the protest organizers would be permitted to visit the mainland. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, Hong Kong marked 1 month since riot police fired tear gas at large crowds of pro-democracy activists. Ivan Broadhead reports on how protesters and politicians mark the occasion and discuss the future.
Tuesday dawned amid a sea of 2,000 tents and countless democracy activists on the streets of the Hong Kong Central Business District. In the cool breeze, a group of students marked the end of the first full month of the democracy protest by singing the lilting refrain of the Umbrella Movement anthem, Under a Vast Sky. The spirit of the activists is typified by 23-year-old Audrey, who says she is heartened that after 30 days of solidarity, of sometimes violent struggle and failed negotiations, the past few days have presented some signs of disagreement between the three groups leading the movement. Benny Tai, co-founder of Occupy Hong Kong with Peace and Love, insists the movement could engineer a citywide referendum to challenge a Beijing ruling that candidates for Hong Kong's 2017 election be vetted by a pro-China nominating committee. Sharing this view is Hong Kong Federation of Students head Alex Chow, but another influential federation leader, Yvonne Leung, is not persuaded. She believes there are other priorities.
We need to think how to further pressurize the Hong Kong government, or is Hong Kong government the right target for us to continue to ask for something, because it is quite clear that in short term, actually, the Hong Kong government will not offer anything else.
Divergent opinion reflects the robust health of the movement, insists the chairman of the Pan-Democrat Civic Party, Audrey Yu.
Well, in fact, that is the essence of democracy, that everybody has his or her own view, and it's very difficult to reach a general consensus.
Ivan Broadhead for VOA News, Hong Kong.
This is China Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, the corruption probe in China snags a top military leader.
It has been more than three decades since communist-ruled China first established its current constitution. A recent top-level meeting focused on increasing the rule of law in China, and the party announced a national day to celebrate the document. VOA's Bill Ide reports from Beijing.
China's constitution was established in 1982 when the Communist Party was opening up the country economically and trying to recover from a deadly and socially divisive Cultural Revolution. Now China is at a new crossroads. The country's mega-growth years have passed, and it is grappling with the massive transformation the past decade has brought, including byproducts such as rampant corruption and environmental degradation, as it reaches for a new economic growth model. Analyst David Kelly of the Beijing-based research firm China Policy says building up the rule of law is important because investors need to have legal guarantees for opportunities in China.
All of the mechanisms of a market economy are really needed more than ever. They were needed in 82, and that's why there were changes in 82.
China is not a market-driven economy. It is an economy in which state-run companies enjoy advantages over the private sector. Government connections are key, and jobs at state-owned enterprises are sought after, which is something the government does not want, Kelly adds.
Global companies that are like Google or Apple, That doesn't happen without assurances that you can make it outside the state sector.
The party is also looking to change public sentiment by focusing on citizens' rights. In a lengthy outline of legal reforms released late Tuesday, the Communist Party talks about the need to strengthen citizens' basic privileges, such as property rights, fair opportunities, fair rules, and political rights. Chinese President Xi Jinping says by 2020, China aims to have completed its transformation into a country in which the rule of law is the norm and where trust in the judicial system is continually growing. He says basic human rights will be respected and guaranteed. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
One of China's top generals has admitted to taking huge bribes. Shannon Van Sant reports on the ongoing corruption crackdown from the Chinese capital.
Former People's Liberation Army General Xu Caiho had been vice chairman of China's Central Military Commission and a member of China's influential 25-member Politburo. Although China has not announced charges against the 71-year-old, Xu has been expelled from the Chinese Communist Party and had his rank of general revoked. China's state-run news agency Xinhua published a statement saying Xu admitted to taking bribes. The article was a culmination of a seven-month investigation by Chinese authorities. China announced the allegations against Xu on June 30th. University of Hong Kong China scholar Willie Lam says,
Xu Caiho is actually the head of a massive corruption ring which involves possibly a few hundred senior officials. He is also a significant case because he was a Politburo member.
Soon after assuming power, President Xi Jinping launched a corruption crackdown in China, banning extravagant expenditures and arresting dozens of officials. Besides Xu, three senior officials have been ousted from the Communist Party for corruption. Former minister in charge of state assets, Jiang Jianming, former vice minister of public security, Li Dongsheng, and former deputy head of the China National Petroleum Corporation, Wang Yongchuan. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
The New York Times reports Beijing police have charged 81-year-old writer Qie Lu with illegal business activities and creating a disturbance. According to Tia's wife and lawyer, the charges are related to his publishing the memoirs of victims of Mao Zedong, as well as his criticism of Mao and China's Communist Party leadership.
The government of Chinese President Xi Jinping is cracking down on dissent and has imprisoned many political activists. Tia has been held in a detention center since last month, and he appears to be the oldest person charged in the current campaign.
Tia and those whose memoirs he published were purged for being rightist after Mao asked for criticism and then punished those who spoke out against his policies.
Chia could be sentenced to as much as 7 years in prison if he is convicted of the disturbance charge, according to his lawyer.
This is China Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, a somewhat murky future for Mahjong.
The Confucius Institute has created controversy on American college campuses recently. Supporters say they are a valuable method of conveying Chinese culture, but critics say the programs do not provide a full picture of Chinese history and current events.
Joining us to discuss the controversy are Terrence Bogolki, the Director of Education at the East-West Center in Hawaii, and Perry Link, Emeritus Professor at East Asian Studies at Princeton University. I asked Professor Bogolki how the Chinese government organizes the Confucius Institute programs.
They're organized through the Hanban, which is the institution that is responsible for these within the Ministry of Education in China. And they are developed through contracts with each hosting institution. They tend to be university-based around the world in some cases. For instance, in Chicago, there's a Confucius Institute with the Board of Education, but most of them are university-based, hosted by the institution. And certainly the scope of programming, you know, is largely dictated by the interests of the Hanban and, you know, has tended to be focused on Chinese language and culture sort of narrowly defined.
I just wanted to just double check with you about that, Professor Bogolki. So that, say, an institute opens on an American campus, is it really the Hanban that determines what the course of study will be? Does the U.S. college, say, or U.S. School have any say in what is to be covered in the material?
You know, I'm speaking from my experience here in Hawaii. The East-West Center is not the site of a Confucius Institute. The University of Hawaii at Manoa is. We do work with the University of Hawaii at Manoa very closely and with the Center for Chinese Studies that is the host for the Confucius Institute there. And we do benefit from some of the programming. For instance, speakers that are supported, where their support coming from the Confucius Institute, at least partial support. So the teaching of Chinese that is done in the CI at UH Manoa is more focused on in its outreach to the schools in Honolulu. There are non-credit kinds of courses that are offered for staff or students, people from the community, and those are taught on the campus, and those are taught by the faculty who come from the Beijing Foreign Studies University, which is the partner with UH Manoa. But as far as, you know, actually teaching credit courses in Chinese on campus, that's not part of the arrangement with the Confucius Institute here.
The Confucius Institute program has grown quite a bit over the past few years, and maybe for some perspective, Professor Link, if you could let our audience know, how did the Institute branches begin on U.S. campuses?
They began, my goodness, must be 15 years ago or so, one by one, and as Dr. Bogolki has said, they vary quite a bit from place to place with different institutions, including ones that are secondary, not university. The fundament of your question, why and how did they begin, is part of a Chinese belief that your language determines your thought. And if you can get people to speak your kind of language, they will think and follow your way. This is very deep in Chinese culture. It goes back to the fundamentals of Confucian education. But the reason it gets political in contemporary times is that you've got competing Chinas, of course, in Taiwan and Beijing and all around the United States. If you go to the weekend schools where people train their children in Chinese, you usually find two schools. One is doing it the Taiwan way and one is doing it the mainland way. And it becomes very contentious and ideological about this is the right way to write Chinese characters, simplified or traditional, and this is the right romanization system to use. Now, the original Hanban idea, I think Dr. Bogolki is incorrect to say that it's in the Ministry of Education. My understanding is that the Ministry of Education is more or less window dressing for it. It came from the State Council and from Party Central, really, and on the theory that if we can spread our version of the Chinese language and Chinese training in the long run, it will pull foreigners' opinions towards the government in China. That's certainly the underlying reason for it. The reason it becomes very controversial, though, especially in the last few years, when it first appeared 15 years ago, it wasn't too controversial. But recently it's become so because of the self-censorship that it induces in the American campuses about what you must not refer to. And of course, there's a long list of these. You can't talk about Taiwan independence or Tibet or the Uyghurs or the Falun Gong or the wealth of the top leadership or anything that the government views as sensitive. So there's a lot to talk about that isn't sensitive, yes, but then it gives to the American campuses and to students on campus the sense that this truncated version of China is the whole story.
I'd come at that a bit differently. I would say that one can certainly conceive of cases where perhaps the China program or the number of China specialists or those who are able to teach and convey a much broader perspective of what's happening in China. Those institutions that are largely dependent for their China program on the relatively small funding that's provided by a Confucius Institute, often somewhere in the range of $200,000 a year or so, that they might be perhaps influenced in the way that Professor Link is suggesting. But in many, many U.S. institutions where there are very large programs dealing with China across the curriculum, I think that the Confucius Institute sort of soft diplomacy and trying to push a China perspective on issues is one source of ideas, but it is really part and actually a very small part of a very large and diverse kind of approach and many, many different approaches to issues, including, and certainly the University of Hawaii campus, inviting the Dalai Lama to come and speak. And this has happened twice, I think, in about the last 5 years or so. Very heavily attended. Tackling a lot of issues dealing with Taiwan and a lot of programming support coming from Taiwan as well.
But you mean on the campus as a whole, not in the Confucius Institute, right?
That's correct. That's correct. And so what I would see is happening is that certainly this funding, the $200,000 that is received here, for instance, at University of Hawaii, certainly that money isn't being used to invite the Dalai Lama or support those issues that you have identified, Professor Link, as certainly really hot and uncomfortable issues for China. But through other kinds of funding, other kinds of programs and departments, those issues are being dealt with on the campus and often quite loudly.
It seems as though Confucius, depending on who is in power, which leader is in power in China, he's in sometimes, he's out other times. But how is a Confucius used in this regard and in academic circles, Professor Link?
Confucius is, of course, a founding thinker in Chinese tradition. And when you refer to the way his reputation has gone up and down in the last 100 years or so, of course, that's a good observation. About 100 years ago, when the great May 4th movement came along, one of the slogans was Da Dao Kong Jia Dian, down with Confucius and sons. There was a sense that the old ways of thinking that were codified as Confucianism were holding the whole country back. Then you get to the communist movement when Confucius' stock went even lower. In 1973, Mao Zedong launched a campaign against his political rival at the time called Lin Biao. And the name of the campaign was Knock Down Lin Biao and Confucius. And of course, it was puzzling to observers at the time as to why these two, one a communist military leader and one the founding philosopher of the civilization, were paired. Actually, what Mao Zedong meant by Confucius there was a veiled way of referring to Zhou Enlai, another of his quasi-rivals. So the poor man has been abused through the 20th century and used for political aims. And that's what's happening now, to be honest. The naming of this soft power approach and this, and put all the other sensitive questions away and just smile and be nice to us approach, is given Confucius as its label because he's viewed around the world as a respectable philosopher, and especially among Chinese overseas, who are looking for a place to pin their identity, their pride in the modern world, and where better than Confucius? If the institutes, for example, were to call themselves the Mao Zedong Institutes now, they would just not have the same following because Mao has got a lot of enemies and is very controversial. So I think there's no question that Confucius was taken, and we have to say taken cynically again. This is just as cynical as it was in 1973. in order to be the label for something that we want to do. We want to spread our soft power.
A bit of irony, I guess, because as Confucius' stock fell under Mao, it's ironically the party that is going back to older times and older ideologies to kind of whitewash past some of the issues that they don't want to bring up.
Yes, but they're not really going back to Confucian ideology. They're simply taking the label. Confucius taught the five relations, how people should treat each other. And the ideology in China today in the Communist Party is basically two things. One is money-making, and the other is nationalism. Confucius would turn in his grave to think that this is what you think I was saying. So the label Confucius is borrowed, but not the ideas of Confucius, no.
Perry Link, emeritus professor at East Asian Studies at Princeton University, and Terence Bigalke, the director of education at the East-West Center.
Games people play, night or day, they're just not matching.
Chinese media are now condemning Mahjong, citing it as an extravagance. Communist Party officials are being urged to avoid the game in order to reduce corruption.
Sarah, of course, the game has been very popular around the world, especially in China, for centuries, with some suggesting that it goes back to the time of Confucius,
who we just heard about indirectly. Well, a commentary in the People's Daily this week said officials are taking the pastime too far.
It said the phenomenon of communist officials going to rural retreats to have fun and play mahjong and poker must stop. It said the practice of betting on games should not be encouraged.
Commentary on social media gave a mixed reaction to the new campaign.
One commentator said the government is increasingly restricting purchases such as matches, gasoline, and fruit knives, and now mahjong, and wondered what would be next.
And here in America, we don't eat turtles and frogs, okay? But they gotta bring that here to America, okay? There's a limit, okay? You gotta assimilate a little bit, Chinatown.
Here in the United States, a San Francisco tour guide's verbal attack on the city's famed Chinatown area went viral on the internet and distressed city officials. The tour guide let loose a profanity-laced rant against the area and its Chinese residents from an open double-decker bus. Speaking through a microphone and drinking out of a bottle, she called on residents of Chinatown to assimilate and criticized neighborhood shops that sell turtles and frogs.
It is the modern age, Sarah, and what the tour guide apparently ignored were the tourists' smartphones that recorded her entire rant, and then, of course, they posted it on the internet.
Your laundry hanging out the windows, your three or four people.
Her tirade has received more than 600,000 hits on YouTube.
Local politicians were not amused. San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee and City Board of Supervisors President David Chu, who are both Chinese American, condemned the tirade. The tour guide and the tour company later apologized to city officials. Tibetan Prime Minister in exile Lobsang Sangay attended a ceremony marking the founding of the non-governmental organization Tibet Charity in India's northern town of Dharamsala.
A government of exiled Tibetans and tens of thousands of refugees are based in India.
The NGO, in its 10th year, has been contributing in the fields of education, social development, and animal care.
Hundreds of Tibetans and supporters gathered at Tibetan Institute of Performing Arts near Dharamsala to celebrate the event, wherein leaders and activists delivered speeches and various artists performed cultural activities.
Sangay hailed the efforts of those involved with the charitable organization.
Despite all the challenges you all have sustained for 10 years, this is a remarkable achievement. You know, in Buddhism, we all are advised by Solemnness Dalai Lama to have a kind heart. But to have a kind heart and do kind things is quite different.
That theme music means we're coming close to the end of our program. We, of course, would like to hear from you. You can email us at voaasia@voanews.com. And please follow us on Facebook and Twitter and check out our program page. It's at voanews.com/China Focus.
And this special message, this is the last 25-minute China Focus. But from now on, you can hear a China Focus podcast every day on our website, VOANews.com.
Well, that beats once a week. We'll have a range of social stories about China for you. We're not going away. We'll just be presenting in a different format.
That's it for our show. I'm Sarah Williams.
And I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for listening to China Focus.